Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and the next two half-hour segments are For the Record program number 215. We're going to be updating matters German. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at a number of areas, growing areas of conflict, between the United States and the German-dominated EU and EMU. We're going to begin with a continuation of the discussion, not really a continuation, but some supplemental discussion to some things that we spoke about in For the Record program number 200, update on corporate Germany. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at the recent struggle between the United States and Germany, and behind Germany, the German-dominated EU, over the head of the International Monetary Fund. We're going to plunge right into the discussion due to limitations of time with this article from the New York Times of Sunday, March 12th of the year 2000. This is an article by Roger Cohen. It's datelined Berlin, March 11th, headlined, Strained Ties, IMF Issue Divides U.S. and Germany, subheaded The Perception of Two Nations That Each Is Throwing Its Weight Around. The article reads in part as follows. The fiasco over the appointment of a new managing director for the International Monetary Fund has caused serious damage to the critical German-American relationship and revealed deep personal rifts within the governing coalition of Gerhard Schroeder, the Social Democratic Chancellor. With accusations flying between Berlin and Washington over one aborted German candidacy and another whose fate remains unclear, two things are evident. Germany's new political assertiveness makes the United States uncomfortable, and the German perception of America is increasingly critical. Michael Steiner, the chief diplomatic advisor to Mr. Schroeder, said, quote, It has been quite an experience trying to hit this moving target set by the Clinton administration. We have discovered that the superpower sees its global role not only in the military area, but also in setting the rules of globalization through the IMF, unquote. He added, again quoting, The superpower in Washington grew stronger, but Europeans are also gaining consciousness of themselves and cannot share the view that the role of the IMF is simply to transport the philosophy of the superpower, unquote. His words reflected a strained moment in a German-American relationship that has stood at the core of Germany's post-war growth into a European power. Again, quoting, The fight with America, unquote, was the unambiguous headline in the influential paper Die Zeit this week over a lead article that was a chronicle of discord. I would note that the United States and Germany are increasingly at loggerheads as Germany once again begins to resume its quasi-imperial role. And once again, Germany is out to replace the leading Anglo-Saxon power as the dominant power on Earth, just as it did in the 19th century, attempting to displace the United Kingdom. Now it's attempting to displace the United States. This should not be interpreted as a blanket endorsement of all of America's economic or global policies, far from it. But nonetheless, Americans should understand that what is looming is the decisive conflict for world control between the United States and Germany, and that's a Germany that was never effectively denazified, and it is controlled by the Underground Reich. I would also add that the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, it wields tremendous influence in the United States. There are numerous tapes available from Spitfire that talk about the Underground Reich. If that seems crazy to newer listeners, and I imagine it might, then please contact Spitfire. Time permitting, I will give the address later on in this program. Skipping down in this New York Times article of March 12th of the year 2000, we read, quote, The German approach was to say, Now we're grown up. We're going to show you we're grown up. And we're just going to do it without prior consultation, without lobbying, without involving our embassies, nothing, unquote, said one American who has played a central role in negotiations. Certainly Germany feels it has grown up. Mr. Schroeder's government has been at pains to make clear that it views itself as the initiator of a new phase in German history, one in which the period of post-war tutelage is over, a Berlin Republic has been born, and the country is ready to drop all adolescent coyness and call itself a great European power, unquote. I would note that Mr. Schroeder also called for all of Europe to unite against the United States, something Americans would do well to take stock of. I would also note that whereas the Clinton administration had successfully opposed the nomination of Kyle Kalkwasser, a joint Brazilian-German citizen, to be head of the IMF, we're going to talk later about the influence of the IMF on the global economy, A knowledgeable listener would recognize in the joint Brazilian and German citizenship the almost certain participation of Mr. Caio Kalkwasser in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and the deadly Bormann Organization in general, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. It controls Germany, it controls Europe, controls most of Latin America, and much of the United States. One wonders what sort of pressure was exerted on the Clinton administration to get the Clinton administration to come around. Certainly, Bill Clinton endorsed Horst Kohler for as head of the International Monetary Fund, and Mr. Kohler has an interesting background. We're going to talk about that later. We're reading now from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, March 14th of the year 2000, an article by Stephen Fidler, F-I-D-L-E-R, in Washington, and Peter Norman in Brussels. This is headlined, Clinton Backs Kohler's IMF Bid, subheaded, Move Seen as Gesture to Ease Tension Between U.S. and Germany, Rather Than Enthusiastic Endorsement. The article reads in part, President Bill Clinton yesterday pledged U.S. backing for Germany's Horst Kohler in the bitter contest to find the next head of the International Monetary Fund. The gesture was expected to ease tensions between Germany and the U.S., which had been severely strained by Washington's public rejection of Berlin's initial choice, Caio Kalkwasser. The U.S. decision to back Mr. Kohler, likely to be decisive in the search for a successor to Michel Camdessous, was widely seen in Washington as an attempt to avoid worsening relations rather than as an enthusiastic endorsement. Mr. Clinton gave the promise to support Mr. Kohler, now president of the London-based European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, in a telephone call yesterday afternoon to Gerhard Schroeder, German chancellor who had lobbied to win the post for his candidate. Hours earlier, finance ministers of the European Union agreed unanimously to put Mr. Kohler's name forward to replace that of Mr. Kalkwasser, who withdrew this month. Note that European finance ministers of the European Union backed Mr. Kohler. And note also that Bill Clinton reversed field from the initial opposition to Mr. Caio Kalkwasser. I've noted in the past that the European Monetary Union was the realization of the theories of Friedrich Liszt for German world domination by uniting Europe under German economic and political leadership and having that German-dominated United Europe as a vehicle for unseating the United Kingdom, Great Britain, as the dominant world power. Those theories were put forward by Liszt in the 1840s. They were realized in the late 1990s, and the dominant world power, of course, is now the United States, not the United Kingdom. Otherwise, things are right on schedule. I've also noted in the past that the Schroeder government is the most nationalistic and chauvinistic German government since the end of World War II. That's now becoming fairly obvious, even to people on the right and left, and I don't think too much of either of the political polarities. There's some people on the left I respect, some on the right, but relatively few on either. And I would also note that comparatively few people on the left or the right seem to be catching on to the real game in world power politics, which is the U.S. versus Germany. This will decide the fate of the world. And I would be lying if I said I was optimistic. Returning, to the New York Times article of March 12th of the year 2000 with which we began our program, more about just how Europe united behind the candidacy of Mr. Kohler. Quote, first the Europeans just had to agree, Mr. Steiner said, then quoting again, Mr. Steiner being a member of Schroeder's cabinet, then we had to agree on somebody with the so-called necessary strengths. Well, nobody can think about reproaching Mr. Kohler for being weak. Nobody can even think about reproaching him for not knowing his job. And Mr. Clinton himself has now said a German managing director would suit him, unquote. The president has indeed expressed interest in a German head of the fund, but even quick American approval of Mr. Kohler, and it is far from assured, that has happened, by the way, after, this 2 days after this story was published in the Times, beginning again, but even quick American approval of Mr. Kohler, and it is far from assured, will not rapidly set right the battered German-American bond that remains the bedrock of America's security interests in Europe. No, indeed, it won't. More about the struggle between the United States and Germany and how Europe was united behind the candidacy of Mr. Kohler. This is from the Financial Times of London of Friday, March 17th of the year 2000. This is an article by Stephen Fidler and Robert Graham. It's headlined, Gunfight at the IMF Corral. Subheaded World News, the Comme des Sous succession, Stephen Fidler and Robert Graham reveal how Chancellor Schroeder rode roughshod over U.S. and European allies to put a German at the helm of the world's leading financial institution. And again, please note that this is the most chauvinistic German government since the end of World War II, and a never effectively denazified Germany is using this, quote, center-left, unquote, government, in all likelihood merely a front for the BND and other German national security and economic interests to basically further its openly chauvinistic aims. Continuing, or reading in part from this article from the Financial Times of London of Friday 3/17/2000, when President Bill Clinton picked up the telephone to call Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder last month, he did so reluctantly. For weeks, Schroeder had been conducting a one-man campaign to place a German at the head of the International Monetary Fund, one of the most prestigious jobs in the world. But Schroeder's candidate, a Brazilian-born German by the name of Caio Kalkwasser, had met with scant enthusiasm either in European capitals or in Washington. The dilemma for Clinton was how to say no to the German chancellor without antagonizing one of America's most important allies, and without arousing the inevitable charge that the U.S. was dictating the terms of succession to the IMF post. It was a difficult conversation, but Clinton left Schroeder in no doubt that the U.S. was ready to veto Kalkwasser. The message was reinforced by a barrage of phone calls from other top U.S. officials around the world. In Washington, officials were guardedly optimistic that Berlin would stage a dignified retreat. But Schroeder defied predictions, raising the stakes to the point where a personal crusade became a defining moment in the transatlantic relationship. Michael Steiner, his top foreign policy advisor, was given the job of arguing that the IMF dispute was about the role of Europe in the world. The threatened veto, quote, shows the nasty face of the superpower, unquote, said Steiner. Then, Germany rallied European finance ministers around Kalkwasser, summoning up a sense of European solidarity in the face of U.S. pressure. As the standoff continued, Clinton again reluctantly retaliated. He got Joe Lockhart, the chief White House spokesman, to deliver an unambiguous message, quote, "We do not believe that he, Kalkwasser, meets the criteria of maximum stature who would be able to reach the criteria of maximum stature who would be able to command support from around the world," unquote, Lockhart told reporters. However, he said the U.S. would still work with Europe to find a strong European candidate. And so began an extraordinary bout of transatlantic diplomacy, exposing the trade-offs and the national rivalries that lie behind decisions taken at the highest levels in the European Union. And please note this last couple of this last sentence, I'm going to repeat it. And so began an extraordinary bout of transatlantic diplomacy, exposing the trade-offs and the national rivalries that lie behind decisions taken at highest levels of the European Union. And again, note that what is taking place on the international stage is a realignment to a considerable extent of the national alignments of World War II with the United States and the United Kingdom, to a lesser extent, allied against a German-dominated Europe, and politically and economically and quite possibly at some point in the future militarily, I think that the conflict, at least from an international standpoint, that was known as World War II, is going to be refought. Certainly politically and economically, it's already being refought, although few in the United States seem to have taken note of this, particularly those on the political polarities of the right and left. And it may very well be refought militarily at some point, too. That would probably well into the next century. More about some of the arm twisting that Germany engaged in order to get Mr. Kohler as head of the IMF, this arm twisting of other European countries. This is the Financial Times. This from the Financial Times of London of Monday, March 20th of the year 2000. This article was written by the appropriately named James Blitz in Rome, headlined "A Motto Calls for Overhaul of Way IMF Post Filled." The article reads in part as follows: Giuliano Amato, Italy's Treasury Minister, has called for a thorough overhaul of the method by which the head of the International Monetary Fund is chosen. He warned that Europe risked losing its traditional right to fill the post with its nominee. In the first public call by a senior European minister for reform of the procedure, Mr. Amato said Europe had to acknowledge the need for, quote, wider legitimacy and transparency, unquote, over the selection procedure in order to preserve respect for the IMF and the rest of the world. Mr. Amato, who appeared strongly favored by the U.S. as a possible candidate for the post, told the Financial Times in an interview the selection procedure has been peculiar and clearly objectionable, one in which, quote, the rest of the world looks on as Europe and the U.S. compete to impose their own diktats, unquote. And skipping down still more about how Europe got, Germany got Italy to go along with its selection, Mr. Amato, 61, admitted he would certainly have accepted the IMF job had it been offered. But he noted that Massimo D'Alema, Italy's prime minister, had said at one stage of the selection process that the Rome government was supportive of the German government, quote, because we are debtors, unquote. The implication, said Mr. Amato, was that Italy had to support a German candidate because Gerhard Schroeder, the German chancellor, had backed Romano Prodi, former Italian prime minister, for the presidency of the European Commission last year. And note again that it was Germany's economic muscle that ultimately was decisive in terms of prevailing on the Italians to back the candidacy of Horst Kohler. More about Horst Kohler's background, reading now from the New York Times of Wednesday, March 15th of the year 2000. This is an article by Edmund L. Andrews at Stateline Frankfurt, March 14th. It's headlined, In the Midst of Upheaval, Yet Out of Public Sight. And this is about the background of Horst Kohler and about his political and economic career. Note what Mr. Kohler has been involved in. Skipping down in this article, again from the New York Times of Wednesday, March 15th of the year 2000, from page 1 of the business section. As Mr. Kohler's representative to the Group of Seven Industrial Nations, he led negotiations over the restructuring of billions of dollars worth of debt left by the collapsed Soviet Union. Because Germany was, and remains, one of Russia's biggest sources of foreign lending, Mr. Kohler frequently sparred with the United States over how countries would divide the burden of refinancing or writing off old loans. Mr. Kohler was also the financial architect of a far-reaching deal with Russia to evacuate its troops from the former East Germany. Under that deal, the Germans agreed to finance an enormous building program in Russia, which would provide homes for soldiers as well as a source of jobs. One of his important legacies was his work in bringing about the economic unification of Eastern Germany with the Western areas. He provided the blueprint for Germany's currency conversion in 1990, under which the former East Germans received one West German mark for every two of the nearly worthless Ostmark. So note that in addition to being instrumental in effecting the political reunification of Germany, and we're going to talk more about that, he also was the main architect of the economic reunification of Germany, which has devastated the economy of the former East Germany and has caused no shortage of hardship and resentment among the, quote, Osties, unquote, among the former citizens of East Germany. I would also note that that economic devastation has fueled the rise of neo-Nazism in the former East Germany. Continuing with this New York Times article of Wednesday, 3/15 of 2000, speaking of Kohler's midwifing and design of the plan for German economic reunification, we read, the plan was harshly criticized by some economists and led to the resignation of Karl Otto Pohl as president of Germany's central bank. But Chancellor Kohl barreled over all objections on the ground that the political reality of German reunification would allow nothing less. Germany is still groaning under the consequences. Eastern unemployment remains nearly 20%, twice as high in the West, partly because prices and wages have soared to Western levels without a comparable rise in productivity. Mr. Kohler also played a big role in organizing the enormously expensive privatization of state businesses in the eastern areas. As a top official in the finance ministry, he organized the Treuhand, the agency charged with selling 11,000 rusting and moribund companies. The Treuhand soon gained a reputation for catering to West German bargain hunters. It supplied tens of billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies to industrial companies that either collapsed or eliminated most of their workers. And as we saw in our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, an expert on matters European and Germany in particular, with an explicitly anti-fascist perspective, the Treuhand simply devastated, Eastern Germany economically and socially, and was bitterly criticized, not just by the citizens of the former East Germany, but also by many others in the world as well. I would note in this regard, first of all, that Horst Kohler was one of the individuals involved in setting up a deal with Russia that enabled Russian troops to evacuate the former East Germany. This particular deal was instrumental in effecting the reunification of Germany, and in that position, Horst Kohler obviously worked with Günter Strassmayr, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, who was the architect of German reunification. I've noted in the past that his son, Andreas Strassmayr, was fingered by ATF informant Carol Howe as the architect of the Oklahoma City bombing. Andreas Strassmayr is a German fascist who was living at the Elohim City white supremacist compound in Oklahoma. Carol Howe informed on the plot to blow up the Oklahoma City bombing, and there are indications that some of the government agents who apparently got wind of the Oklahoma City bombing were either on hand or aware of the bombing. They also appear to have been doubled on by what I personally view as a fascist fifth column within the United States government. I do not believe that Oklahoma City was a provocation. I do think that there were elements within the U.S. government that were aware of the bombing. Certainly Carol Howe, who stated that Andreas Strassmayr was the architect of the bombing and that Timothy McVeigh was his protege, she warned her superiors, and there are indications that there were government agents on site at Oklahoma City. This has been construed by the racist right and some of the elements of the conspiracy crowd as indicating that Oklahoma City was a provocation. I cannot state without qualification that that was not the case. I don't believe that that was the case because of the media handling. There are very firm indications that there was much more than just Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols involved in Oklahoma City. There has been an absolute cover-up of the Andreas Strassmayr connection. Nobody has mentioned his connection to Günter Strassmayr. They simply say he's the son of a German official. He's the son of Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff and the architect of German reunification. Andreas Strassmayr, a former German military officer, was present at the reunification ceremony and had a German government security clearance. It was not the American government that, in all likelihood, arranged Oklahoma City, but the German government and the underground Reich that dominates it. I would also note that there appear to have been two explosions. There are indications, as discussed in a number of analyses and updates on the Oklahoma City bombing, that there was one explosion inside of the building, in all likelihood placed by explosives experts working for the underground Reich, and also another explosion outside, quite possibly within a truck. I am of the opinion that the federal agents who had been alerted by Carol Howe, who, by the way, passed a polygraph test and then was subsequently subjected to legal proceedings and officially at least discredited or ignored, there are indications that the government agents who were on site at Oklahoma City may very well have been the target of an outside explosion. My own feeling, again, was that a fifth column at work within the U.S. government doubled on those who were aware of the impending explosion within the U.S. government, and that a second bomb may very well have been intended to kill government agents on the scene. We've already seen that type of methodology in some white supremacist and fascist terror bombings in the American South. I believe that same methodology was used in Oklahoma City. And again, in the book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, the Oklahoma City bombing is linked with the murder of Nicole and Ron and the framing of O.J. Simpson. Again, I think that Oklahoma City was not in all likelihood a provocation. It's to be noted that with the end of the Cold War, the racist right in the United States and elsewhere has turned against the United States, and with the Soviet Union destroyed, with the cradle of socialism destroyed, the cradle of political democracy and multiracialism is now being targeted for destruction. And as imperfect as the United States has been in those regards, it is the cradle of both and has been targeted for destruction. The racist right has turned against the United States, and I believe that They are deliberately perpetrating terrorist acts and then blaming them on the United States government as a whole as provocations in order to discredit the United States. And again, I believe that the underground Reich, as I have termed it, has infiltrated the U.S. and has a very profound fifth column within the U.S. nationals and political the national security and political establishments, and that fifth column is very much at work today. And it is that fifth column, I believe, that doubled on the sincere and patriotic U.S. government agents that tried to prevent Oklahoma City, because I believe there were some. Again, I cannot state without qualification that it was not a provocation. I don't believe that to be the case. Now, this will appear to be something of a digression, but bear in mind the fact that Horst Köhler undoubtedly worked with Günter Strassmayr very closely in German reunification, and bear in mind also that it was Horst Köhler who was the architect of German economic reunification, something that proved altogether brutal. I'm going to review an article from and some information from For the Record program number 200. This from the Financial Times of London of March 11th and March 12th of the year 2000. This is a profile of Horst Köhler. It's entitled Germany's Euro Hero. A man in the news, Horst Köhler, a driving force behind the single currency, should not be underestimated as a potential IMF head, writes Ed Crooks. And of Mr. Kohler's background, we read, he was born during the Second World War in what is now Poland. His family fled to East Germany as the Russians advanced and escaped to the West in 1953 after he was 10. I would note that his family fled the military approach of the Allies, that he was originally born in Poland. One certainly cannot draw too many conclusions from that, nor from the fact that he fled the former East Germany. It was not a particularly pleasant place to live. Nonetheless, many anti-fascists stayed there precisely because they knew that in the West, fascism was being reinstalled behind the scenes, and that due to the fact that powerful U.S. interests backed the Third Reich. We're going to continue with this discussion in Side 2 of For the Record Program 215. I alluded to a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's Post Office Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. And that website is also equipped with real audio so the listeners can hear the For the Record programs going out to the various stations that carry this program. Again, if some of the references that I've made seem obscure or preposterous, listeners can check out some of the various tapes available from Spitfire, which carry the appropriate documentation and supplemental discussion, including a number of programs about the Oklahoma City bombing. That concludes For the Record program number 215, Side A. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.